1906.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yesterday, Charlotte Mayor Patrick Cannon was arrested by the United States Justice Department on federal corruption charges. A U.S. District Court also issued search warrants for the mayor's office, Cannon's home, and his business, Easy Parking. Later in the day, Cannon sent a letter of resignation to City Manager Ron Carley and City Attorney Bob Hageman, saying that in light of the charges that have been brought against me, it is my judgment that the pendency of these charges will create too much of a distraction for the business of the city. Well, the FBI alleges that Cannon, a Democrat and Charlotte's longest-serving elected official, became a person of interest in the course of another criminal investigation. That led the Bureau to launching separate investigations into Cannon in August of 2010, in the course of which, they say, the mayor accepted $48,500 in cash, as well as things of value from undercover FBI agents posing as commercial real estate developers and investors wishing to do business in Charlotte. They allege he did so in his official positions as Charlotte mayor, mayor pro tem, and/or as a city council member. The Justice Department says the last payment of $20,000 was delivered to him in the mayor's office. Cannon was released yesterday on bond and becomes the region's highest-ranking official to be charged in a corruption case since Jim Black, a former Speaker of the North Carolina House from Matthews, was charged and later convicted for corruption. Patrick Cannon faces multiple charges, each with their own sentencing possibilities and fines, the greatest of which would be 20 years in prison and $1 million in fines for wire fraud. I'm going to take a closer look at what these charges are and what implications they hold for Cannon and for how politics and business, including the business of government, is conducted in Charlotte. We're joined by WFAE reporters Ben Bradford, Michael Tomczyk, and Tom Bullock, who have been following this developing story, as far as I can tell, all day yesterday and all night last night. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
The announcement of this arrest, I think, surprised everyone. Nobody in the press, nobody in city government, nobody had any inkling this was coming down.
That's right? Absolutely right, Mike. I was actually down at Government Center yesterday, and news of this broke at about 1:30. We raced down to try to see what was going on, and the mood in the building was exactly as you described. It was shock, surprise, a lot of sadness. They had arranged for a press conference that kept being delayed. I was actually in the communications office trying to figure out exactly what was going on and when it would happen. And I actually could overhear members of the staff asking each other, who's going to say what? What is going on? And the mayor's office is on the 15th floor of that building. I went up to see what I could see. And the entire wing that has the mayor's office, the city manager's office, as well as the legal department, was completely locked off. The security doors were closed. They had armed guards. They immediately turned around. Everybody who came up that wasn't there on official business, no comments were made. The only thing that we actually heard came at about 4:30, and that was actually by Mayor Pro Tem Michael Barnes, who had this to say at that press conference I was attending.
The City Council is deeply disappointed to learn of the mayor's arrest. Our thoughts and prayers are with his family. His arrest came as a complete surprise to the City Council and the City Manager.
And everybody who was at that press conference that wasn't a member of the press, the eight City Council members and City Manager Ron Carley, they had real looks of shock and surprise, and all of them said that they were sad to hear the news.
This investigation has been going on for almost four years,
sure.
And it outlines the affidavit that the federal government filed against Patrick Cannon outlines a lot of goings on that seem to be it seems to be behavior that must be going on a regular basis. So how can nobody know? How can nobody suspect?
Right. Well, I mean, certainly some people suspect, right? I mean, you look at how this got started, and you had a local undercover law enforcement agent. So, you know, we would surmise that's CMPD, mm-hmm. who was posing as a businessman and mingling around with other people in Charlotte's business scene. And on another case not related to Cannon, he got kind of a whiff of that there was some kind of public corruption, notified the FBI, and then the FBI sends in their own guy. This is back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes down, again, not looking at Mayor Cannon, but he gets introduced by the CMPD officer as a businessman, as a guy representing a venture capital firm?
So let's be clear here. This original investigation that brought Patrick Cannon to the attention of the FBI was being conducted by local authorities.
That's right.
Or the FBI?
It started out as a an unrelated case by a local CMPD, what we assume a CMPD officer.
Is that investigation ongoing? Do we know the outcome of that investigation?
We don't know what that investigation was, and it was unrelated to this particular case. And it was unrelated. What happened is he was working on some other kind of case. And the only thing we know is from the complaint form that the U.S. Attorney's Office filed. And he got some kind of hint that there was some kind of public corruption, notifies the FBI. They send their own guy.
Why would the FBI be notified? Why wouldn't local authorities just continue the investigation and handle it themselves?
We don't know that. It's actually not listed in the affidavit. It's 42 pages long. It has a lot of details. That is not one that's in it.
Okay.
And there are a few reasons for that. All of that would be guesses on our part. We have to stay to the confines of that document. They don't go into further detail. But whatever it was, as Ben was just describing, it rose to the level that some local undercover official, we again assume it was CMPD, felt the need to notify federal officials that a potential crime was underway. The FBI then sends this their own undercover agent down, who sees enough that they launch a sting operation.
And you know, we don't want to kind of guess why or what happened, but we do know in other cases that when there's a feeling that public officials or the people who ultimately make decisions in the police department, for instance, right? I mean, you know, the city council and the mayor have authority over that. Cannon actually served on the public safety committee that makes decisions about policy for that stuff. And we know in other cases, I mean, you can think back to the city of Cherville, where they've had a number of arrests of police and people in City Hall, and the State Bureau of Investigation and the FBI both came in there and did a variety of operations, including a sting operation.
So this has been going on for years. Do we understand why they pulled the trigger on this yesterday, why they decided to make the arrest and stop the investigation yesterday?
No, it's the short answer, Mike. And a lot of that may come out here once the grand jury proceedings are over. Mm-hmm. What we can tell you is what led up to this. We can go through quite a lot of history.
And
but
I think we have some hints of what may have gone down yesterday. And I think that we can talk about that while sticking to the facts.
Well, what did go down yesterday? What was the sequence of events? When did the press find out about it? When did city officials find out about it? Because they were in the dark until it happened.
Absolutely. In fact, they said at that press conference that they didn't know what was going on until federal agents showed up and presented a search warrant at Government Center to search the mayor's office. That was around noon yesterday. Then a press release was sent out to members of the media. It was about 1:30, and that's where we got all the allegations against Patrick Cannon.
Yeah, I found out when Michael Tomczyk said something inappropriate.
And you went to the mayor's residence. The affidavit which was supplied by the Justice Department to a federal judge is essentially what's the word I'm looking for?
It's a charging document.
It's a charging document, and allows the judge to understand why he should issue a search warrant and an arrest warrant. The arrest warrant was obviously issued, and the search warrants were issued for the mayor's office downtown, for his office at Easy Parking, which is the company that he runs and owns, and for his home. You went to the house. What was the scene there?
So when I got there around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and there were blinds were closed, garage was shut off, and there were 5 cars parked either out front of the house or right by the house. 2 of the cars had FBI jackets sitting in the back of them, so clearly you would assume they were FBI agents. We went up to the front door and knocked. A man wearing a suit came up and waved us off. So then we were basically just waiting there for a couple of hours. And then the neighbors, actually, we talked to some neighbors, and they said that those cars had been there since about 11 o'clock in the morning. And then around, I think it was about 5:30, go ahead, Mike.
No, go ahead.
And then around 5 or 5:30, we had all of these men and women in suits come out carrying boxes. One was carrying a CPU, loaded these things
into the computer tower.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The bottom of the computer. Yeah. Loaded all of these things into the cars and just drove off without saying a word.
Yeah, the affidavit lists certain things that they wanted. They wanted an iPad because the mayor has at one point in a conversation said that he was going to schedule a meeting with one of the undercover FBI agents on his iPad. So they want computers, anything can transmit on the internet. They want his cell phones. They want financial records, And they're getting that from three different locations. And they want a briefcase, which we'll talk about a little later on. Governor McCrory said, "I am both saddened and angered because I have known Patrick and his family for over 30 years. But more than anything, my heart is broken for the city of Charlotte. This is not the city that I know, served, and loved. This alleged behavior is inexcusable and cannot be tolerated." And the governor, the governor's brother, and Patrick Cannon were on this program about a month ago because Patrick Cannon was the governor's brother's little brother in the Big Brothers Big Sisters program. They seem to have a great relationship. Have we heard from any of the other former mayors of Charlotte about what happened yesterday?
I think that our colleague Lisa Miller talked to Harvey Gantt.
Who had nothing to say.
That's right.
He also did not endorse Patrick Cannon. And there was a comment in the newspaper this morning that said, if you don't get the endorsement of Harvey Gantt, that speaks volumes. What have we heard about his political support in the city prior to becoming mayor? What do we understand about that?
Well, you know, I would say that there was obvious tension between between Cannon and other members of the city council. It came – you could really see it publicly during a lot of the streetcar conversations. You remember, you know, that was former Mayor Anthony Fox's big project. And, to some degree, that may have looked like a political rift where there was just a simple disagreement over how do you pay for the streetcar. But at the same time, I think that there was also some real personal differences and some feelings that I think there were some personal differences
okay.
there.
The city manager Ron Carley made a statement yesterday afternoon at that press conference that you attended, and here's what he had to say:
"The mayor is not the executive. Mayor does not appoint the staff and does not supervise the staff, and so it is actually illegal for the mayor to give directives of any form, whether they are of a lawful or unlawful nature, to a city staff."
He's referring, when he talks about directives, he is referring to the mayor making promises, allegedly making promises to undercover FBI agents that he could do things for them.
And at least in two points in that affidavit, there seems to be moments where Patrick Cannon acted. And again, these are all alleged. Mm-hmm. This is all coming from the federal authorities involved in the case. The first seemed to deal with Patrick Cannon calling an official, some member of city staff, who had something to do with zoning and development and saying, you know, we need to kind of – I'm summarizing here, but saying that he need to kind of push through this project. Mm-hmm. Another is when Patrick Cannon gave contact information to another city – you know, member of city staff, and basically told this undercover FBI agent, "Call, drop my name. We'll make sure that this goes forward and let me know that it's working."
Ron Carley made a point of saying, and I quote, "The mayor is not the executive. The mayor does not appoint the staff and does not supervise the staff." We're joined by Dr. Eric Heberlig, who's a professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. We have a weak mayor form of government here. He doesn't have any power, really. He's a figurehead. Patrick Cannon, it could be argued, had more power when he was a member of the city council because the mayor only votes to break ties. How unusual is it for something like this to happen in a city where the mayor really isn't the power authority figure?
Yeah, when you think of bribery cases, you're thinking of cases where the mayor has the ability directly to
like
deliver
Chicago.
Something. Yeah. And here, you know, when I first heard this yesterday, I was like, well, why would someone bribe the mayor? he can't do anything. But what Cannon is alleged to have done is basically made these calls, kind of leaned, try to push things through the process in many ways like a member of Congress does, you know, saying somebody's filed this petition or please move on it. And the city staff then presumably responds to the public official.
I'm going to come back to this in just a moment. We have to take a break and we'll do that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Christopher Warren Green conducts A Little Night Music, three works by Mozart and Haydn's Farewell Symphony No. 45, tomorrow at Knight Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. Carl Zimmer is considered the top writer on genomic science and everything related to it. He's written 13 books on a number of other science topics. He writes a column for the New York Times, a blog for the National Geographic. Most importantly, though, He makes complex science understandable to the average person. And Carl Zimmer will be in Charlotte, and he joins us to talk about how he does that, how he makes science understandable, and a little of what we all should understand about science. We'll do that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama and European leaders concede there's not much that can be done about Russia's annexation of Crimea. Western powers weigh responses to Putin's possible next moves.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the arrest yesterday of Patrick Cannon, former mayor of Charlotte, who resigned last night at about 7 o'clock as a result of being charged on federal corruption and wire fraud charges. We're talking about this with Michael Tomczyk, Ben Bradford, and Tom Bullock, all from WFAE News, who have been covering the story since it broke. And Dr. Eric Heberle has now joined us. He's a professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. In January, former Virginia Governor Bob McConnell was indicted on fraud and conspiracy charges. Three members of the House of Representatives have pleaded guilty to or were convicted of crimes in 2013. Courts have found eight governors and former governors guilty of crimes since the year 2000, two from Illinois alone. There seems to be a rise in white-collar political crime. Is that the case, or is it simply the case that they have refocused their attention on white-collar political crime and therefore are catching more of it? It's been going on all along, but just hasn't been caught.
My guess is more the latter, more their investigating abilities have changed. But certainly there has been a rash of it in the last 5 years that we hadn't seen probably for the previous 10 years before that. So it's hard to know what to attribute this to other than investigating, because clearly politicians know there are few ways to lose if they're in a safe district unless they're being caught being corrupt.
And I think it's important to point out that actually as we were investigating these charges against Patrick Cannon, news came down of another FBI sting operation involving a state senator from California. It's not just over the last 5 years. Just in the last 24 hours, we've seen at least two high-profile.
Actually, and there's a third one in there as well. There's another one in New York. So you got to imagine they kind of packaged these together to release on the same day. I mean, I can't imagine that all three investigations wound up perfectly ending on the same day.
So are we to assume then that the Justice Department is taking a closer look at political crime at the state and local level around the country?
It certainly appears that way.
Why would that be?
I think once they get started on these investigations, as we saw in the complaint against Cannon, it was somebody that essentially brought an accusation to them, and they were doing other investigations at the time and then expanded their investigation into Cannon and found, as was documented, a number of incidents.
What do arrests like this of a Charlotte mayor – this has never happened before in Charlotte. We have this reputation of being squeaky clean in terms of our governmental operations. What does this say to the electorate? What impact might this have going forward?
Well, I think it has an impact beyond just the governance aspect of it, because as we pointed out, the mayor doesn't have a lot of power to do particular things or to deliver any corrupt promises. But what it does do is really undermine the trust of the electorate in what's going on at City Hall. If they think that city officials are on the take or are not going to use tax money correctly, they're going to be less willing to support when the city says, oh, we need to raise taxes to do X, Y, and Z, or we need a particular economic development plan.
And to Eric's point, I mean, so these allegations say that literally Cannon accepted money in the mayor's office at the government center. So, I mean, it is literally at what our version of City Hall is. This is where these things actually went down.
And I just want to add one thing to what was just said here, too. At the press conference yesterday, the mayor pro tem, Mr. Barnes, had a really interesting thing to say. He was asked by a member of the media whether or not they had any guesses, they being city government, of any kind of other crimes or, you know, allegations or investigations going on. Was everything that was happening at City Hall clean? This is what he had to say.
The city of Charlotte has a long history of honest government, and the city council is dedicated to preserving the city's reputation. It is our expectation that all business of city government be conducted honestly and fairly.
Now, what he continued to say just after that was, but with everything that's come out today, you just don't know. Hmm. And then a little bit later on, City Manager Carley came out to say that, you know, we will conduct any internal investigation in cooperation with federal authorities. It leaves kind of a question that even City Hall can't answer right now.
Well, Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiOrio issued a statement yesterday afternoon saying that they were aware of the allegations against the mayor. They were reviewing the documents and criminal complaint. They were aware that there are references in those documents by canon regarding the county's code enforcement process. So how closely is the mayor tied to the county? Does the mayor of Charlotte have any sway, officially or unofficially, like through arm twisting or political favoritism, with members of the county?
Well, I mean, obviously the county and the city have to work together. I mean, you can see it probably most significantly was in this land swap that happened to build the Knights Stadium.
Okay.
Where and Romare Bearden Park, we just did a story about that. And it ended up being this complicated land swap where the insurance company Mass Mutual owned some land and that the city wanted to build the stadium. The city owned a park. And so they kind of negotiate with each other and ended up swapping all of the land and for the city giving up Marshall Park, for instance, the county agreed to include affordable housing in another development that they were going to try and build. So obviously there's some mingling. At the same time, I mean, they are separate entities.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
But I just want to add one thing, too, and I think this goes back to something you said earlier, Mike. Patrick Cannon was the longest serving member of Charlotte City government. He served as a councilman. He served as mayor pro tem, and of course, he served most recently as mayor. Over that span, he is bound to have created some kind of connection, built relationships that may extend logically just beyond the, you know, artificial confines of what is city government versus county
government. And he was connected in the business community because he got his start because of Hugh McCall, who was then the president of the Nation's Bank, Bank of America.
Absolutely.
And had real estate contacts with major players in town because of his business connections. Michael.
So to answer the question, you know, official versus unofficial, I mean, the reason you would bribe the Charlotte mayor is the unofficial side. This is a person who is very connected. This is a person who knows this community back and front. So it's clearly, you know, yes, our city manager has a much stronger role in the way that our form of city government is set up. But at the same time, you know, we always talk about the mayor and the role they play in business and in attracting business. And these are the kinds of things that, based on these allegations, are exactly what he was doing.
Which raises serious questions about how business, the business of government and the business of business and the interfacing of the business of business with the business of government comes to be done in the city of Charlotte. Should we be concerned about this, or could this just be an isolated incident of one bad apple, allegedly one bad apple spoiling the whole thing?
Well, we certainly hope it's an isolated incident, but we heard criticism of Mayor Fox that he wasn't as accessible to the business community as they were used to. And it's not to suggest that there was any type of...
And they were used to that because of a long-term mayor, Patrick McCrory,
right,
who was there for 14 years.
Right, and presumably mayors before that. So certainly in terms of the planning of Uptown Charlotte, the history is that it's the banks that kind of set the agenda. This is how we're going to do it. And there's obviously a legitimate way to do that and an illegitimate way to do that. But when much of this is by relationships, by picking up the phone, that means people who have connections to get somebody with power to pick up the phone are going to have an advantage.
We've talked a lot over the years on this program about how business used to be done, and it was the seven people who ran the city who were not elected. They were the head. They were captains of industry, the heads of banks, the head of the Charlotte Observer, the head of Jefferson Pilot Broadcasting, all people who got together and said, here's what the city needs to be. Here's what it needs to look like. We're going to get this done. Let's make it happen. Bang. And it happened. Those people have gone away. Nobody has filled that vacuum. Is that why we have an incident like this now where smaller players with less power have more to gain by acting in an unsavory fashion?
Well, I would also say that those players could set the model for how things are done in Charlotte. And if they saw people coming up in the ranks that they thought were kind of shady, they could marginalize them and keep them out of positions of power. Now with a vacuum, by definition, there's no screening process that's going on.
And I just want to add one thing to that. I mean, if you think of any political corruption case, there are three core building blocks: money, people in power, and regulations. Now, we have all three of those easily in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. The people in power can be either business leaders or politicians. It doesn't – I'm new to Charlotte. I just moved down recently. But it doesn't surprise me that you're seeing this, as we have just said, not only here but in other cities and other states as well. I think even though Charlotte does have a – or at least did have a squeaky clean reputation mm-hmm. for city government, doesn't mean it's not going on.
Mayor Cannon, Patrick Cannon mentioned that being mayor of Charlotte was his dream job. He just got this dream job about 3 months ago, 2.5 months ago. I'm not even sure what the timeline is. Explain to me why somebody would put that dream job at risk for $48,000.
Because as the allegations show, he'd been doing it for a while. And I suspect you get to the point that once you think you've gotten away with it, you just keep doing it, and the ability to be mayor gives you the ability to leverage even bigger bribes from people. I mean, you see this, say John Edwards' case, the former senator. He wasn't taking bribes, but he was cheating on his wife. And, well, once you do it once and don't get caught, well, it just expands. And politicians tend to have these narcissistic personalities that, they think they can get away with things once they get away with it once.
That's right. If you look through the documents, I mean, it starts with – in 2010, this particular investigation. But what you got to remember that what sparks it is sort of hearing about, hey, this is how a business is done with this guy, or finding evidence that that similar instances had happened with Cannon. And they're not laid out in there, but they between 2010 and 2011, the U.S. Attorney's Office says it collected evidence from witnesses, from documents, financial records, other sources, phone analysis that he was engaging in this kind of activity.
Tom. Yeah, and I actually want to go back to that first instance of a bribe that Ben was just talking about, because I think that's actually rather telling in why exactly Patrick Cannon would do this. The first steps are kind of tentative, and they're a little odd, so you're going to have to bear with me. Everybody's made the jokes that this sounds like a bad movie script. It does, but this is what the federal authorities are accusing Patrick Cannon of doing. The first bribe was not – When Cannon allegedly solicited the money, the word bribe was never used. It was never released. That's not surprising. What is the fact that he asked for it to be seed money for this side project that apparently the mayor had in mind. Now,
this is the feminine hygiene product.
I'm glad you said it. Yeah. No, you didn't. Yes.
A
business project, the feminine hygiene product called Hers. Now, we've dug around. We can't find anything about this except for, as Ben pointed out in our story this morning, a $1,000 transfer to something called, something in Taiwan, and it was labeled R&B.
And it's extremely sad that the FBI took that CPU away, because the complaint talks about Cannon actually creating a spreadsheet and some rudimentary slides about Hers. So I would love to get a catch of like what that is.
Yeah. But all jokes aside, this is where it gets tentative, and you can kind of see the evolution of this, in at least the way that it's presented. Shortly after receiving $12,500 in a bugged apartment in Charlotte, Patrick Cannon learns the news that then mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, had been indicted for bribery charges. And he gets what seems to be, at least to me, Ben, cold feet. He actually makes a phone call to the federal agent.
At least it's on the same day.
Yeah. And says, this isn't a bribe. This is seed money.
Yes.
He then offers to return the money, but he never does. And from that point, the money, I think it's fair to say, it starts to become more of a steady flow.
In the affidavit that they filed yesterday for the arrest warrant and the search warrants, they have a lot of verbatim conversations between Patrick Cannon and various FBI agents. In that conversation, he says, this is Cannon talking, relative to permitting and anything else that you need, that's just me and how I operate. But there has to be a linkage. If there has to be a linkage between the two, then I would much rather see you before you get on that plane and give that seed money back to you, because I'm going to help you regardless with what you need on the public sector side. I certainly cannot have my reputation, my values and ethics put on the line to do something on the public side with a connection to something that I need help from you on the private sector side, because I'm not one of those Chicago or Detroit type folks. And then he goes on to say that he looks good in an orange necktie, but not an orange suit, meaning the prison garb that people wear. Could that be viewed as somebody trying to walk back a misunderstanding? Could he argue, could Patrick Cannon argue that it was never anything more than a sidebar issue? It was never a quid pro quo. And I wanted to make that clear in that conversation because of what happened to Mayor Nagin in New Orleans.
Right. I think that that is certainly how that conversation seems, except for, you know, if you go back a little bit further, you go back to the day before that when the again, according to the affidavit, as you said, when the money's exchanged. It happens directly after. I mean, the conversation, you probably have it in front of you. I do not. Where the agent says, you know, hey, if you can help me with getting through these regulations, he ostensibly wanted to start a bar or a nightclub in Uptown. He says, if you can help me cut through the red tape here, then I think I can get an investment for you with this HERS product.
And just to add to that, too, this is the first instance. Mm-hmm. It goes on from there. And I think it is worth pointing out, at least according to the affidavit, he may have offered to give back the money. He never did. And
it never came up again.
Well,
and he never gave any details about the progress of the investment or where that stood, right?
That's right. He never mentions HERS again, according to the complaint. And also, they said that they gave opportunities, set meetings, and Cannon did not show up for them to discuss giving the money back.
What does that say?
I think that's up for a judge to decide or a jury. But, you know, the key thing here is that cash was – that was in January of 2012. At least according to the federal document, he would accept six more cash payments up until he was arrested yesterday.
Now, this cash, this initial cash, $12,500, was given to him in this apartment, which is described in the affidavit as a luxury apartment in South Park, which the FBI had outfitted with cameras and microphones. And they say that when they gave him the money, they put it on a coffee table in that apartment, and that Patrick Cannon looked very nervous about it, put a folder on top of the money until the agent, the FBI agent, closed the drapes.
And at which point he did what?
He picked up the money and fanned himself with it.
and flipped through the bills.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, which is
I think that
talk about Chicago.
Mm. Well, actually, talking about Chicago, I think, you know, that isn't even the craziest thing. I think the most brazen bribe or alleged bribe here obviously takes place in the mayor's office.
Seriously?
And I mean, this is straight out of a movie script as well. It involves, you know, this undercover agent posing as a businessman coming in to bring another undercover agent who is posing as a skeptical foreign investor. Cannon, you know, wants to convince this guy to put up more money for this alleged project that he's being told is being built. He invites the skeptical investor to Charlotte, takes him around town, shows him these things that he claims that he has done, and then they meet in the office and talk. After that skeptical investor leaves, Cannon is sitting there with a briefcase. It's described as a brown leather fossil briefcase. Inside is $20,000 in cash. And that is significantly more brazen an act. I mean, he is sitting there in the government center in the mayor's official office with a suitcase full of money.
Let me ask you this. To get in – go ahead. I'll ask you the question.
Yeah. So I was going to say when I read the first transcript of that initial meeting about the HERS project, I thought, well, a good lawyer could probably
Absolutely.
Take care of that. But once you get to the final incident in the mayor's office where you have Cannon actually discussing how the guy can get out of the building when there's videotapes of him coming in with a suitcase and what they might need to do to so that doesn't raise suspicion that the briefcase is still in Cannon's office. You know,
it's
hard to get around the fact that now he's deeply in the conspiracy to engage in the bribery activity.
We have to take a break. I want to clear all that up because that's an important part of all this, and it's probably a little unclear to people who have not read through the affidavit. We'll take a break and come back and do that with Michael Tomsic, Ben Bradford, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News, and Dr. Eric Heberlig, political scientist with UNC Charlotte. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Data Science and Business Analytics Graduate Program at UNC Charlotte, where business and data science come together to create our region's future leaders in big data. dsba.uncc.edu. Well, President Barack Obama and European leaders concede there's not much that can be done about Russia's annexation of Crimea. Western powers weigh responses to Putin's possible next moves. That's the topic of the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. here on WFAE. I want to remind you, of course, that we will keep you up to date on the developments in the Patrick Cannon story as we go through the day and as the events develop. You can also find them on our website at WFAE.org. And we will continue our conversation about all of this. And if you have questions or comments, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is the place to start. We're coming right back.
Even when a news story is changing really fast, Morning Edition is taking the time to collect the dots. And we're careful about how we connect them. This takes a lot of patience. Covering news honestly means that we are all figuring out the story together in real time. Listen every weekday. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Comprehensive, in-depth morning news, weekdays from 5 till 9 on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Michael Tomczyk, Ben Bradford, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News, and Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte. Let's go through the whole thing. We started off, the affidavit lays the whole thing out, the affidavit that they used to issue the arrest warrant. The timeline.
Right.
It begins with this $12,500 exchange for HERS, the product that Patrick Cannon allegedly was trying to get financing for. Then what happens? And this happens over a course of about 3.5 years.
That's right. That's right. So later on, that was in January 2013, January of last year. And a couple of months later, that undercover agent introduces Patrick Cannon, who's a city councilman at the time, to another real estate investor who's who's from Vegas and is looking to do a mixed-use development here in Charlotte and wants to get foreign investors.
I'm going to stop you because let's go back to the initial meeting between the undercover officer.
Yes.
Which led to the $12,500.
Yes.
Initially, he was looking for a piece of real estate so he could open a bar.
That's right.
And the mayor suggested some spots. Okay?
Sure.
Now, one of the spots he suggested was going to be in South End, but this guy decides the undercover agent decides he wants to put it downtown. Now, did he want to put it downtown as opposed to South End because it would be more difficult to get zoning changed and therefore that would lead the mayor to have to act in some way to make that happen?
Well, certainly it says in there that the location that he shows had parking problems, that this agent settled on had
right.
parking problems and would need a series of zoning and permit changes.
So could it be argued then that he had options in both places? He could have taken the easy option, but he chose the hard option to test the mayor, that he was testing the waters to see if the mayor would react in a certain way. And if that's the case, could it be argued then that that's entrapment?
Well, I'll speak a little bit about entrapment too, because let's step aside from the actual document here for just a second to discuss what exactly is about to happen. You know, probably as early as next week, Patrick Cannon is going to stand before a federal grand jury. They're going to decide whether or not to indict him on this series of charges. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the grand jury proceedings, there is no defense. This is the prosecution's chance to present the case to a jury, and they basically say, do you think we have enough to go to court?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that this indictment comes down, which is more often than not the case. Then you're going to have Patrick Cannon and his legal team. They get to do what's called the discovery phase of a trial, which means they start getting all of these documents that the FBI and the U.S. attorney have, all of the transcripts. What we can see now are just excerpts. They're going to get the whole things. And as you said, this went on for years. So there are bound to be reams and reams and reams of nothing but conversations that they're going to go through, and they're going to look for moments where they can build a defense or poke holes. And that's where we get to entrapment. Now, entrapment itself is – entrapment's a little tricky to prove, but what entrapment is let's say the defendant is pushed so hard by some undercover agent to break a crime that he almost has no choice. Entrapment means that the federal government, in this case undercover FBI officials, go too far trying to push Patrick Cannon to commit a crime to the point where it's not just allowing him to do it, it's encouraging him to do it. Now, that is separate from the sting operation and the fact that the sting operation itself is nothing more than the series of surveillance and notes and everything that the FBI took part in.
At what point do we know this became a conscious sting operation as opposed to just a little toe in the water kind of thing?
2011. At 2011, the complaint says that Cannon had become the primary target of this investigation. They had this undercover FBI agent who was he was already posing as a businessman. And at some point by December 2012, he and Cannon are sitting down to dinner and they're talking about trading money for permit stuff.
Let's get back to Vegas because
let's go to Vegas.
Okay, let's go to Vegas.
Let's go to Vegas.
This is where Undercover Agent 1 introduces Patrick Cannon to Undercover Agent 2, who is allegedly a business guy who wants
Vegas
to do something big in Charlotte.
Oh, yeah.
In the multi-million dollar.
He's trying to raise $125 million from foreign investors, and he needs Patrick Cannon's help to do it.
So they fly Cannon to Vegas,
yep.
Patrick Cannon and his wife to Vegas, give him $1,000 in spending money when they get off the plane. Then what happens?
Cannon goes, and this has been agreed upon beforehand, he goes and he meets with a number of foreign investors, in reality more federal undercover FBI agents, and he tells them that, hey, I've known this developer who I met, you know, who he met 3 months ago, who's actually an agent, that I've known him for years, that he helped, that he was involved in the Metropolitan Development, which has the Best Buy and the Target just outside of Uptown, which, of course, you know,
completely false.
Yeah, exactly. So that's not true. And that I've got his back. I can help him with anything. I can probably get federal money for this. And
Is the fact that he misrepresented his relationship of one FBI agent to another, the fact that he said, Patrick Cannon allegedly said, that he helped this other agent get his development, the Metropolitan, through some sticky situations, is that illegal?
Under North Carolina law, you're not allowed, and I'm sure federal law as well, but under North Carolina, you're not allowed as a public official to use your influence to favor a group of investors, particularly if they're giving you money.
Is it illegal? is it illegal? Well, at that point, there was no allegation that it's completely false. It didn't happen. But is it illegal to say that it did? Is it illegal to misrepresent to someone that you did?
Well, you can't.
When you didn't.
You can't misrepresent. I mean, there's investing laws that you can't.
And I think, too, I'm not sure – personally, I'm not exactly sure whether or not it is illegal under North Carolina statute.
Okay.
But what is clear here is this is a moment of conspiracy between Cannon and the undercover – the original undercover FBI agent. It was Cannon's idea to come up and use the Metropolitan as an example. It seems to be Cannon's idea to lie about what he did and to try to show off his power to convince these fake foreign investors to pony up the cash to help the development go through.
And to do that, before they ever go to Vegas, Cannon says, hey, so I'm going to help you. I'm going to do this. How about a political contribution? I've got June 30th coming up. There's another member of the city council who's looking at running against me. By this time, he's a mayoral candidate. We know later on that Councilman James Mitchell ran against him. He says it would look good on my report if I had a substantial campaign.
A bigger war chest.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it led to a $6,000 contribution, correct?
Well, it led to $6,000 in cash.
Yes.
Slight difference there. And what this all shows is this tit-for-tat exchange for favor, influence, whatever you want to call it, by Cannon to get cash from the undercover agent.
At one point during the many conversations that are alleged in this affidavit between Patrick Cannon and the several undercover FBI agents that are quoted in the affidavit, which led to the arrest, Cannon makes a point of telling them that he is a close friend of the governor. He discussed his relationships with North Carolina State Senator Robert Rusho from Matthews, who is a Republican, and that he would be meeting and partying with President Obama in the next few days. In fact, he did go to Washington. He talked about it on this program and went to a party and had several conversations with the president about city business. The agent then replies in a way that sounds a little cynical given what we now know. He says, you're operating at quite a level, Patrick. You know, you haven't even hit the pinnacle of your political career yet, have you, Patrick? It'll be fun to watch you in the next 10, 15, 20 years. Watch where you go.
Well, and
wow,
yeah, it's pretty sobering in retrospect.
And what's interesting to me, at least, when it comes to this, we're now getting to the end of this timeline, the end of this sting, just before Patrick Cannon is arrested. And what you also see is as this agent is kind of puffing up his ego, Patrick Cannon then starts puffing up his demands. We now see the single largest direct cash payment alleged to be given.
This is the $20,000.
To Cannon, this is the $20,000. But in addition to that, you also have the mayor allegedly asking for a lot more than that.
A point.
And that would equal, at least according to federal charges, that's 1% of the $125 million fake development that Ben was just talking
and
about.
And he lays it on his wife. He says, I told my wife she ought to get a point, which is $1.25 million. That was never resolved. It was to have been resolved yesterday.
It was indeed. And although WFAE has yet to be able to independently verify this, the reports are that Patrick Cannon was arrested at the apartment that we've been talking about. He went there, apparently, to negotiate how that money would be paid to him.
That's right. This thing happened in the complaint where it says that the final kind of part of this timeline that the U.S. Attorney's Office has produced is that they drop off the leather briefcase containing $20,000, and then they agree to meet at a later date to discuss how they're going to exchange the rest of the money. And that date was set for March 26th, which was yesterday.
Let's go back to the $20,000 in the fossil briefcase that was brought into the government center by this undercover FBI agent. Then there was a conversation ensued between him, allegedly, and the mayor. And the mayor said, just leave it here. And if somebody asks you about it, tell them you forgot it.
And that's after a little bit of discussion about what they should do.
How does somebody walk into the government center with a briefcase with $20,000 in cash in it? You have to go through screening to get into the building. How does that happen?
It's certainly not clear from the from the complaint. Every time I go into the government center, they search my bag.
Yes.
Thoroughly.
How does that happen?
Yeah, I would think that the security agent at the door would say, hey, that's a lot of money in a briefcase. What are you going to do with that? But yeah, that's not addressed at all, whether there was any reaction by the security official.
I mean, he is an undercover agent. I mean, so we don't know what happened there, but you've got security working there. So perhaps I don't want to speculate.
So
on it, but
in the search warrant that is issued by the government, they want the security tapes from the government center because in the elevator lobby outside of the mayor's office and in other areas outside the mayor's office, they noticed that there were security cameras. And the security cameras could be used – the tapes from the security cameras could be used as corroborative evidence to prove that the FBI brought a briefcase into the mayor's office but did not leave with it. How unusual is it to depend on a tape that may or may not exist to be corroborative evidence of such a major factor in this case, $20,000 in a briefcase?
Well, and it's a good question, Mike, and I'm not exactly sure the specific, but there's a good defense lawyer can poke all kinds of holes in this. Unless the undercover agent basically is under some kind of surveillance from the minute he sits down in Mayor Cannon's office to when he walks out.
Well, he is wired.
He is wired, but if they're looking, they're obviously looking for some kind of visual proof. And, you know, there's in law enforcement, there's this chain of custody issue. You have to make sure that everything is controlled by somebody every step along the way, even with the security cameras, unless there is a video record of every step going into the building, into the office, and then out of the office, you know, it's not a stretch of the imagination to see a lawyer arguing, well, all you've done is prove that he didn't have it in the lobby. Who knows where it ended up?
There are also a list of cash deposits made by Cannon at the end of this document.
All under $10,000.
That's exactly right. And because you go over $10,000, you
the government knows.
Right, yes. They generate a currency report.
And I mean, it's a measure basically done to try to combat money laundering.
The money in that briefcase, the serial numbers were recorded, allegedly. Are they going to be able to find that money? Did they anticipate finding that money at one of the locations they searched yesterday?
Again, not clear in the report, but I mean, they do lay out, for instance, that $10,000 that a day after receiving $10,000 from that second agent, Cannon makes a deposit of $8,800.
Tracy on Facebook says, why did it take 4 years and five money exchanges to get him arrested? Why could the FBI not have done this before the election? That's a very good question, because they knew this was going down before he became mayor. Why? Why now? Why yesterday?
It's a very good question for the FBI.
Why not arrest him before?
I think that's right. And again, we don't know the We do know that there was this meeting set for yesterday, right? And if this meeting, which the complaint suggests, it does not say outright, but if this meeting was to talk about how do we transfer the rest of this $1.25 million to you, I mean, that's a more severe crime than a $10,000 gift.
The language, if you read through the affidavit, which is, by the way, available to read, it's a public document, and so you can...
We have it on our website as well.
Okay. If you read through this, some of the language... Going back and forth, of course, the FBI guy is acting. Well, it's not real. But the mayor is not acting. The mayor is being the mayor behind the scenes. And the language is macho bravado and a lot of bluster and just plainly cavalier attitudes towards the office and the way he conducts himself in office, if these words are what, in fact, he said. What are we to get from this? Is this how business is done? In the big boy business of politics and business?
In some ways, yes, in the sense that you want people to think that you're powerful and can get things done for them. Otherwise, you know, they have little reason to give you campaign contributions or to come and get their problem solved and vote for you. So, yeah, that is part of the game. The problem is not his bluster or claiming to be able to do things, but explicitly exchanging money for what he's done as a public official.
Now, the city will now go ahead and appoint a mayor to serve out the remainder of Patrick Cannon's term. Why? Why don't they hold a special election? This is the second time this has happened in 2 years. Anthony Fox left to go be the Secretary of Transportation. They appointed a mayor to serve out his term. But that was a short amount of time. This is almost the full term. Why not have a special election? And if you don't have a special election, what does that say about the importance of being mayor of Charlotte? It's just a figurehead position.
Yeah, the city ordinances spell out the process when someone vacates the position, what is done. You could change the way you do it, but that would require changing the city ordinance.
How difficult are these kinds of things for a defendant to fight? I mean, this is a very intricately laid out document.
It seems like, I don't want to use the term slam dunk case, but it seems pretty solid. But the important thing to remember is, again, we are looking at what the government wants us to see, what the government sees as its best case against Patrick Cannon. The defense has years of transcripts and years of surveillance they'll be able to go through to look for any slight contradiction, a misstep by the government to prove that Patrick Cannon was either entrapped or is innocent.
It's Tom Bullock from WFAE News, who's joined us along with Ben Bradford and Michael Tomczyk, also from our news department, and Dr. Eric Heberlich, political science professor at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.